I entreat you all to come a little closer for warmth, for warmth, literary warmth. This is our last session. It's gone by so very, very quickly. I hope everyone's enjoyed what they've been to so far. It's been great having you all here. I'm killing time as you all find seats. There we go. You know and love her already, so I'll make a very brief introduction. Everyone's happy ending, Amanda Stern.
What's that?
It may go off any moment.
Okay. Thank you for that. Hi, everyone. It is nice to see you. To my left is Colson Whitehead. He and I are going to have a conversation in front of you about the business of writing. And what I'm going to do is basically take you and him through his biography. And I'm going to ask him some tricky, hard questions. And then you can ask him some tricky, hard questions. And then he's going to read a little bit. So please welcome Colson Whitehead. Hi, Colson.
Hey, howdy. Thanks for having me.
What I want to do is start from really early on. I want to know a little bit about I want to know what you were like as a child in New York City, where you grew up.
Yes, I grew up in New York City. I didn't like to leave the house, so I would stay indoors, retreating into my own private world. You always hear about people like James Joyce or whatever, you know, who were shut-ins and withdrew into their own private world. So I aspired to that, and I read a lot of comic books and science fiction, and I thought early on that I wanted to write X-Men or Spider-Man, or I was really into Stephen King. I think I was in seventh grade when I decided that I wanted to write and be the black Stephen King. So I wanted to write like the black Salem's Lot, the black The Stand. If you took any Stephen King novel and put the black in front of it, that's what I wanted to do.
And what did your parents do?
My parents were executive recruiters, which is like companies go to them and they say, we have this spot and we need someone to, we're trying to hire somebody, so can you find this person for us?
That's what my dad does.
Really?
Yeah, headhunter.
Headhunter, yeah. Black headhunter, different sort of ring.
Mine too.
So executive recruiter, headhunter, and they worked together, and they worked actually in our apartment, so I got into the whole, like, it wasn't good for the marriage, but it inspired me to want to work at my own house, which I do to this day.
You have siblings, I know, and where do you fall?
I am the third. I have two older sisters and one younger brother.
So
one is 8 years older, one is 4 years older, and my brother is 10 months younger.
So what do you consider yourself, the second youngest, third oldest, or the middle?
My brother and I were sort of like twins. We're only 10 months apart. I guess the term is Irish twins, but maybe that's not PC. I'm not really Irish, so I can't really say Irish twins.
No, you can take it. So
we're like, at the times we had like a sort of Lenny and George from the Of Mice and Men thing. So I was like a sort of caretaker of my little brother, and trying to keep him out of trouble. And then my sisters are kind of much older, and so they were sort of surrogate mothers. So we were sort of like two babies with two surrogate mothers.
All right, so essentially what you're saying is that you were the youngest as well.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
I was a youngster and a caretaker.
Pretty tricky.
Yes.
And you went to Trinity. Were you at Trinity at this point?
I went to Trinity High School for high school. I went to a weird elementary school called Fleming, which is closed down.
Fleming. My mom went there.
No.
Yes.
What year? Maybe we're in the same class.
1913.
So it was a weird French-English school, and a lot of like diplomats' kids went there. Basically, my dad thought that there was going to be a race war in the 60s, and so that we should know a second language. And why he picked French and not like Spanish, I'm not sure. But so he sent all of us to like, this French-English school so that in case the race war came down, we would have a second language and we could flee to like some English-speaking language. I'm not sure why he assumed that we wouldn't be down with the race war, or that we wouldn't win. I mean, that's sort of like, race war, got to flee. Why not, take up arms?
Fascinating. I have no response to that, really. Except for, why not the lycée français? Maybe it didn't exist.
They didn't have, like, hand-to-hand combat.
Got it. Okay, so you went to Fleming, and then you went to Trinity, and you spent your high school years at Trinity. And as a student, what type of a student were you? Did you excel? Did you rebel? Were you writing?
I was really good until I got to college, and like there were no parents around, so I started like not going to class. So I got to college, and I was like, oh, I'm a rebel. But the thing about like not going to class is that in retrospect, you're only really hurting yourself because you're there to get educated. So you're not like being a rebel by like sleeping in. But all through high school, I was a good kid. Nerdy, didn't get into trouble. And so on.
Okay, and then at college, you went to Harvard, and you majored in?
English and American Literature.
Okay. Now, had you started writing seriously at all, or were you just sort of writing stories for yourself, or what kind of writing were you doing in this period of time?
Yeah, I wrote maybe two short stories in high school. About like monsters, in keeping with Stephen King, and then at Harvard they didn't have like a creative writing major. You had to apply to get in, and I was turned down all three times I tried to get in. My stories were, I wore black and I smoked, and so I thought that made me a writer. And I write like 5-page, really intense stories about depressed guys walking across the college quad, and no one really liked them. And so I wrote. Maybe like 3 short stories in college. And I think it was very instructive because I learned that actually nobody cares or will support you in your work. So that was like a good lesson to learn early. A bitter, sad, bitter lesson. But it helped me later on when I did I started trying to write longer pieces and no one cared or gave me support or encouragement.
Well, most people would have given up after being rejected 3 times. So
yes.
What made you continue? Why didn't you give up?
I just knew I would do it even if nobody cared. I mean, that came more into play later when I started writing fiction. I was trying to get novels published and nobody cared. But I sort of knew I would get my act together eventually. And so I really started writing seriously when I got out of college and I got my first job, which was at the Village Voice. Working in the book section, and I started writing articles, book reviews, and TV and music reviews for Village Voice, and that sort of gave me, that was like my sort of apprenticeship.
And did you go straight from graduating college to working at The Voice? Like, how did it work? What was the transition?
Well,
how did you find your way in there?
I drove across country with some friends, and then we didn't have any money, so we came back to New York, and then we had to get jobs, because we didn't have any money. And so I stayed at my parents' house for like 6 months, and then after Thanksgiving, they were like, get a job. So it turned out they had an internship open at the Voice Literary Supplement, the book section of The Voice, and so it was 6 months of really sort of being a layabout and not knowing what I was doing, and then sort of trying to pick myself up and become a decent semi-human being.
And do you remember at that internship what sorts of things they had you do?
Well, I had to answer the phone and I would go VLS because I had this sort of radio reporter, a radio guy voice I would do because I stutter occasionally. So if I don't do funny voices, sometimes I stutter. So I would get nervous. I'd never know who's on the other end of the phone. Perhaps you've experienced this. So I'd have to do voices. In order to perform my duties of answering the phone. I had to open up the books every day. We got 40 books a day in from publishers. and it was my sort of job to, you know, stack them, sort them. So that was a really sort of depressing job for someone who wanted to write, because you actually saw how capricious the whole system was. We got all these books a day in, 40 books. We reviewed maybe 40 a month, and the rest, you know, they would sit around, people would take them home, then eventually they get sold to the Strand. Mm-hmm. Like, my boss is making so much money off the Strand on these free galleys. It turned out to be like 10 grand a year off the books.
Really?
And that's like 90s money, yeah.
Who did he talk to at the Strand? Because I brought back a lot of great books, and I got $18.
Well, it was like galleys. Yeah, whenever I was like broke, I'd bring stuff in, and they'd be like, you know, here's pizza money. But they were like galleys, like, you know,
right.
Really, the primo stuff.
I hear you. I got the primo stuff. They don't pay a lot for it. It's very sad. So you went from answering the phone, opening the mail, going through all the books, sorting them. How long did that last? And then what happened next? What was your next step?
Well, you know, I'm not sure if you guys, you know, the voice now is pretty... It's not what it once was. I pretty much, no matter when you worked at the Village Voice, like that was its heyday. So if you worked there in the 50s, you know, when Norman Mailer was running it, that was like the heyday. If you were there in the 70s, when they were covering disco and CBGBs, like that was the heyday. And then whenever you leave, that's when it starts to suck. So I was there from like 91 to like 96, and that was like its heyday, and then it's sucked since then. But the great thing about it was that they really encourage you to write, and so you hang around the office, and you go to like the TV editor and like say, can I do my first piece? And he's like, well, you can write about the season finale of Who's the Boss? That's next week. And you go, yes, and that's your first piece, and then you can show it to other people at the paper. So I started writing first the TV section, and then the book section, and music, and a little bit of film stuff. And over time, I just became more confident, because if I wrote like a really good article, people would say, hey, Cole, good job. And if I wrote a dud article, I'd hear nothing. If I was like too self-indulgent or used the first person too much. Mm-hmm. So I was getting a lot of feedback from readers and people on staff and my friends. I would learn how to write for different editors. You know, they have different ideas of what they wanted to put in their section. So in the TV section, if you talk about Derrida, the editor was very happy because you're elevating this low cultural form. And if you talked about comic books in the book section, they're happy because you're merging high and low, and that was really like edgy. So I learned about having an audience, writing for an editor, and also just sitting down for like 6 hours straight to hand something in. Because if you have to get an article in so you can, get food, and cigarette money or beer money, you learn how to sit down for 6 hours and get it in and get paid. And so I learned how to, really sit for concentrated amounts of time.
Wow, that's amazing and sort of a rare thing I find in fiction writers that they don't normally know how to write for editors that way. They don't really usually learn that way. I think that's really lucky and a great skill to have. So you developed a clip folder.
Yes. I was pretty much a failure of writing for any other magazines. Because whenever I had an idea to pitch, it always sounded horrible on paper. But I could execute things well. Most of my books sound pretty horrible if I just tell you what they're about. But I think they're better on paper than in their brief description. So that was like my freelancer problem I had. But at The Voice, they knew me. I was a known quantity, and they'd throw me work. And eventually, I was getting enough work that I didn't have to keep my day job there. I could just hand in articles. And eventually, after like a while, I started working on a novel. Like, I never really wrote good short stories. I wrote like, six as a teenager. But I just wanted to write fiction, and the novel seemed to be the form. So I didn't write short stories and had enough time as a freelancer to work on a novel.
So you were balancing nonfiction with fiction, and your whole world pretty much after college was entrenched in journalism, it seems.
Yes.
So while you were writing pretty much strictly nonfiction, what made you want to write fiction? Did you feel like you were resenting nonfiction, or did you, could you balance both? Did you want both?
There are different forms, and you know, definitely towards the end of my career as a critic, I was sick of just pontificating. I mean, I just had, you know, I'd rather just be a passive consumer of pop culture as opposed to someone who has to come up with the significance of the shaky camera in ER, you know, or whatever. I'd rather just watch stuff and enjoy it. So by the end, I was sick of being a critic, and I don't do that much anymore. But there's two different things. I mean, there are two different ways of getting at the world, nonfiction and fiction. So when I write essays now, I'm just using a different tool to talk about things. It's just a different way of thinking about, of approaching things. So, but in terms of fiction, I just knew, you know, I sort of decided that I was going to be the Black Stephen King. And then as I was introduced to more serious contemporary fiction in college, you know, I became aware of different ways of approaching the problem of literature. In the work of Ralph Ellison or Thomas Pynchon, these sort of 60s, 70s postmodernists, and I want to write like them. So I was writing my cultural stuff in The Voice and trying to find a device in fiction that would allow me to sort of talk about the culture and have characters and have them interact. So a lot of my first attempt at a book was very theory heavy about pop culture and not so much a sort of really living novel.
And this first book, is it a book that we know, or is it a book
It's not a book you know. It's so strange. Because I was writing a lot about black imagery and pop culture, I thought it'd be funny to write a book about a Gary Coleman-esque child star who we pick up 10 years later and he's being abused by a Time Warner-esque entertainment combine. And so I got an agent, you know, through a friend, and it turned out that no one's actually interested in a novel about a Gary Coleman-esque child star who gets abused by a Time Warner-esque entertainment combine. And at the time I had like some ideas about pop culture, but I didn't have a way of integrating them into a interesting story. I didn't have any characters. I didn't have a real vehicle to get my ideas across in a way that wasn't just sort of a overblown essay or overwritten thesis. So, you know, my agent sent it out to 20 different people. They all hated it. They stopped returning my phone calls, and then one day they're like, we're dumping you.
The agent.
Yeah, the agent dumped me. And I guess the moment where I really sort of knew that I was a writer was when I spent, you know, half a year just watching Jerry Springer and writing stuff for The Voice, and I was like, well, I'm not going to become a lawyer or a vet. I just have to write the next book. And they might get it next time, or they might get it in 4 books or 5 books. But I don't really have a choice. So I think that's like the main. So I think that was like my sort of moment of, I'm a writer. But there's nothing else I could actually do well that would make me happy or had that sort of life imperative, so I had to just start over again.
Okay, there's a lot here. Let's go back a little bit. So before you got your agent and you were writing this novel, you were sort of working thematically, it was sort of the same themes that you were working on.
In my nonfiction.
Right. So there was an overlap there.
Yes.
And did you feel like these themes that you were working on or working with was that what was going to drive you? Did you feel like this is my thing? This is what I need to write about. This is what's going to drive me forward.
I think there are, you know, in a way that there's. I said I had like ideas about how pop culture worked, how we received the mass media, how blackness functioned in the culture, and I had made a living sort of talking about it. Black stereotypes in movies and film, What is the gangster and gangster rap, and what does it mean for the culture? And I was used to that, and I you know, loved people like Thomas Pynchon or Don DeLillo, who could talk about social systems or cultural systems and also have characters and have them interact and have it be part of a, of one sort of unit. You know, you could talk about culture and have a compelling story and have it work. And at the time, when I started writing fiction, because I hadn't done it a lot, I had no idea how to do both.
Right. So your relationship to both forms at the time was sort of the same, is what you're saying.
I was just writing under different ways of
talking
about things.
So then how did you learn about writing a novel? Through reading?
Yeah, I mean, definitely with my first attempt, I was just sort of going, and I thought the idea was enough. I started breaking it down more concretely with The Intuitionist. I knew that my first novel was aimless, so I was reading a lot of detective novels, and I thought the detective novel structure could teach me about plot. It's linear, it's A to B, there's a quest. You string the reader along, you frustrate the reader, but it's very linear, and you're going towards a goal. And so I thought if I could mimic like neo-noir writers like Elmer Leonard or James Ellroy or Walter Mosley, I would learn about just the form of how to tell a story and keep the reader interested. Mm-hmm. So The Intuitionist started as just I'm going to do a jokey detective novel. And I was watching TV one day, and I saw a piece on escalator inspectors and the hidden dangers of escalator inspectors. If you have small feet or your little child, you can get your foot caught in the treads and you lose a toe. So 2020 was interviewing an escalator inspector. And I thought, oh, that's a weird job. You don't think about that. And then from growing up in New York City and seeing the elevator inspector certificate in all the elevators, I thought, oh, what if an elevator inspector had to become an inspector? And so, and this elevator inspector would solve a criminal case. And I went to the library to sort of figure out what skills an elevator inspector would bring to a criminal case. And it turned out there were actually none, because they learned about elevators. So it became all about elevators, and it took place in elevator world. So I didn't invent a culture and lore and a way of talking. And so from this sort of simple idea that I want to have a plot-heavy book and that sort of jokey, I came up with The Intuitionist, which is about elevator inspectors.
So this is pre-Google, I take it.
Alta Vista.
So how many years are you now out of college at this point?
I started in 96, so I guess like 5 years.
Okay, and in that time you never considered going to graduate school?
I had friends who were getting their MFAs, but at the time I didn't like, I was really sick of school, mm-hmm. and so it seemed like I could apply to school, or I could just start writing. And I had the time, and I had an idea, so it seemed like
the time.
What the heck?
Right.
Yeah.
And so now, just to go back a tiny bit again, with your first novel that we haven't read, that got you your first agent. How did you mentioned that you got the agent through a friend? So can you explain how that happened?
So I worked at the Village Voice, and so a lot of people there had nonfiction contracts, and so I just went to my friend Scott, can I send my book to your agent? He's like, yeah, sure. And so, you know, being in the journalism world, I knew people who had agents, and so had multiple sort of folks I could hit up.
Mm-hmm. So then, okay, so now you're working on The Intuitionist, and you're doing all this research, but you don't have an agent. And how many years do you spend working on the book without an agent?
Well, I decided that I was just going to do it, and I realized it was about elevator inspectors, so it was probably not going to go anywhere. And I was just like, I'm cool with that. I'm just going to do it. I'm going to do it. And I spent how long? About 6 months doing research, and then I had a very intense time where I was writing like three days a week on the book, and then I would take a day off to write an article, and that would like pay for another 3 days of work on the book. That's how I looked at it. If I got $400 for an article, that was like 4 days work, and then I could work for a couple days before I had to write an article again. And so that was like a very intense period, and I didn't, you know, I was going a little crazy because I kept writing Elevator 100 times a day. And then and when I told people what the book is about, they were like, that's crazy. So I got to 100 pages, I started showing people, and they're like, it's not too bad. And that gave me the drive to, you know, plow through to the end. So I ended up actually writing it in about 10 months. It was like a really sort of intense time. I was really broke, so I ended up moving to San Francisco at this point. I got a job at a .com. And I really had no rush. I was in no rush to find an agent or anything or revise it. And then someone who had passed on my first book, I sort of ran into them, and I told them I was finishing a book, and my agent had dumped me, and she was like, well, you should talk to this new agent, Nicola Raji. She's just sort of starting, and she might dig your stuff. And so when I was ready to send it out, I sent it to her, and she dug it and sort of got the book immediately, so I was very fortunate.
So was she the only agent that you approached? Wow. Did you ask her any questions?
Like what?
Like the questions you're supposed to ask agents?
No, I mean, I sort of, knew my friend vouched for her, and I only do due diligence. Like, for example, my first agent dumped me, so
right.
Maybe if I'd asked the right questions, I wouldn't have been dumped.
Yeah. Or you would have dumped them.
Right, exactly.
Before signing on. Okay, so then, so you're in San Francisco
mm-hmm.
when Nicole takes on your book.
Yes.
Okay. And then you're working in the .com bubble.
Yeah, it was a CNET, which is like a internet news site, was trying to do like a Yahoo type web portal. It was all the rage. Everybody had to have their own portal. So I'd gone, and so my job was to write a listings of web chats on the web, like weekly web chats, like a cuckoo for your cockatoo, go to pets.com for the weekly pets chat. And I was burning with rage. It was like, I've written two novels, no one likes them, and I was actually a functioning journalist, and now I'm like sort of doing this. But I had to like sort of pay back all the debt I made from writing The Intuitionist, so it was sort of like, I had to pay for the book. So
you didn't meet Nicole in person?
No.
Fascinating. Okay, so then she had the book. How long did it take her to sell it?
She took it in July or August, and then that was like a dead time. So she sent it out after September, and then it was picked up pretty quickly by Anchor, like pretty quickly,
like within hours.
Like a week or whatever, whatever.
I guess everything is within hours, right?
Yes. Yes.
So she sold it within hours. You should just say that.
Yes.
She's to Anchor. And at the time, you were working at CNET, but were you also starting work on something else? Were you?
Well, in terms of like the idea, I was out of debt. It was only like $1,000, but it was like a lot. I borrowed from my sister, and it was hanging over me. And I was out of debt, and I knew I was going to start another book. And so the very nice thing happened where I quit my job, and I figured I would start freelancing again and work on my next book, whatever it was. And like a week later, Nicole had sold the book.
Okay.
And I told my mother, and she was like, don't quit your day job. Like, I already did. Quit my
so. So when you started working on your next book right then, was that John Henry Days?
Yeah.
That period. So, so who was your editor at Anchor?
Her name is Tina Pullman, and she we'd known each other, and she was the person who'd recommended Nicole to me.
Oh, okay.
She'd passed on my first book. I think she was like, it's not good, but maybe the next one will be good.
Right.
And so she knew, you know, that it was going to be sent out and very, really quickly, and sort of made an offer that we took.
Okay, so it sells, and then the period of time that passes, as I'm sure most of you know, is long and excruciating. And who said something about it's the calm before the calm? Do you know about that? So what was your life like right before it came out?
Well, I mean, I hated San Francisco, but I started working again. It was like a really, looking back, it was just a really sort of great time because I had money to live on. I took six months off to plot John Henry Days. Like, I always plot books before. I think it's like a journalism thing, because I'd always, you know, because I was such a, I was always like trying to cheat when I'd write an article. So it's like 400 words, like, here's a 50 word quote. Or, and then like, you know, so three paragraphs, 50 word quote, and then like a kicker, and I'm done. So I'm always like, I would always like plan how to like do the least amount of work. Or, you know, just like plan it really, pretty far in advance before I start working. And so with novels, I try to do an outline. You know, it can change. But I know who, like, the characters are and the major sort of beats. I know, like, what the ending is, definitely. I know what the beginning is. The middle can get fuzzy. And as I do research, it gets sort of bigger and smaller and changes. But for me, I have to know what the map is, what the last page is going to be. So I outline John Henry and then start just wrote. And so people, you know, say, I like the idea, I felt good about it. Mm-hmm. I had this validation. I was really angry about the intuitionist because I hated everybody. And this is like, wow, a book coming out is really nice. I'm not just some kind of weird freak who writes Elevator 100 times a day. Mm-hmm. And so it was really a really sort of nice time. And then people say like the second novel jitters. Well, because, you know, there's 15 months between them buying the intuitionist and it being published, because they're trying to find out the right month for a first novel. And at that point, it was like January was like a safe month. Now March is like a safe month. You know, every year there's like, March is like a safe month when the first novel that broke out came out. And the next year, all the new novels come out in March. And then, but that year was in January. So I had, you know, 15 months to work on John Henry Days. It was half done. And so when The Intuitionist came out and I got good reviews, I wasn't, you know, paralyzed, like, what do I do next? I actually had, you know, most of the book. I knew what the ending was. I didn't have to, like, cast, you know, I wasn't, like, lost or anything.
Right.
So after, you know, it took 6 months where I was sort of, like, walking around, walking to Earth, but then went back, to, you know, to finish John Henry Days.
Okay, so then when you sold John Henry Days, you got a two-book deal, is that right? Or not?
No, it was for one book.
All right, so they bought John Henry Days, and then we have to speed up a little bit because I think I might have spent too much time on your childhood. So they sold John Henry Days, and was the pattern the same in between John Henry Days and your next book coming out? Were you writing another book, or were you writing the essays, or?
Well, yeah, I guess when John Henry Days came out, I had about 80 pages of Apex Hides That Hurt,
mm-hmm.
and I'd written like a few of the chapters of the Colossus of New York, which is a series of essays about the city. But they weren't a book; they were sort of like a side project that I was doing.
Colossus or Apex?
Colossus, okay. Was. And so I had like maybe three Colossus chapters, and then like 80 pages of Apex. But I knew what Apex was. And then 9/11 happened, and I started writing more nonfiction about the city, and in the way that a lot of people were, I was like, oh, fiction doesn't matter, you know, it's so juvenile, making things up is ridiculous, and I couldn't relate to Apex, so I just started writing Colossus full-time and writing about the city, and a lot of it was about trying to figure out how to live, like, in my hometown after it had been attacked, and so it was very useful psychologically, but it put Apex on hold. And then when I finished Colossus, I went back to Apex, and I realized that I wasn't really the same person. I didn't like the main character anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I was stuck for a year because I didn't know how to make the protagonist interesting to me again. And it took like a year of sort of just figuring out how to change him so that I could relate to him again. And so basically, after 9/11, my idea of the book changed, mm-hmm. and it took me a while to figure out how to make it work again for me.
Yeah, it sounds like your whole relationship to fiction changed after 9/11.
I guess so. I don't know. Yeah.
We can talk about that at dinner. So then within that year, Colossus came out.
Yeah.
And then you. How long did it take you to figure out? You had that year to figure out the relationship to the character. So then, did you just barrel out the rest of the book? How long did it take you?
No, the timeline is off now. I mean, I guess because I figured it out, and then like my wife and I found out we're having a kid, and so I was like, oh, I gotta finish this book before the kid comes, and then like I did nothing. I just listened to like 80s music. I had this weird like regression into like the 80s because I've become like an adult finally, and so I didn't do anything when I should have been working. And then once my daughter was born, I was like, now I really got to work. And I had this sort of crazy fit where I finished the final third of the book. So.
Okay, and then that sold. And then when did you start writing the next book at that time?
I sort of like, before I finished Apex, my new book is about a town called Sag Harbor, Long Island. It's in the Hamptons. And in the 30s and 40s, black professionals, lawyers, doctors started going out there. And it was a weird sort of little bubble of black upper middle classness in the Hamptons. And so my mom grew up in Jersey and would go out there in the summer. And I grew up in the city and would go out there in the summer. And so, you know, one summer I was out there and I was like, I guess I have a lot of stuff to talk about here. I think, like, you know, generally, if you spend summers out there, you go to college, and then you're like, oh, this place is so bougie, you know, and I'm all militant. I can't be hanging out with these, like, you know, hoity-toity people. But then, actually, later on, it's just sort of a nice place to go in the summer, and you hang out, and you don't really see the Hamptons of people. You just sort of see your friends and have barbecues. And so I thought, like, I wanted to really sort of reconstruct 80s teenage life and set it in Sag Harbor. And so, for the first time, it was a book that wasn't like, didn't have like some kind of crazy ass premise, like, mm-hmm. how do I update John Henry for the information age? It was just sort of like, how do I write about being a teenager in 85 without like, say, like that kind of Stand By Me thing where they find a dead body and then like mm-hmm. they're on the run from the cops or something, or like the KKK. Like, I don't know what you put in coming of age novels to make them interesting, because I don't like them. So how do I make a story of a summer interesting without any sort of big, you know, dramatic thing? Mm-hmm. So that was like the task, I guess.
It's interesting to me that your coming of age novel was your last book. It's usually someone's first.
Well, I think I was so I was one very theoretical when I started writing, and also squeamish about talking about things are really close to my experience, and so it took a while for me to just become comfortable writing about just like a kid and not like an elevator inspector.
Mm-hmm. And so it's called Sag Harbor, and it's coming out in April. So, mm-hmm. I think we have to almost turn it to questions. So do you want to read something to us?
Yes, I would love to.
That would be great.
So usually when I finish something, I hang around for a while and don't do a lot of stuff. But I started working another book in the spring, and I guess the idea was that, you know, there comes a time in every writer's life when you should start working on an anthology. And so so a year and a half ago, like in the spring, I started assembling an anthology on the writer's craft. I'm going to call it How to Write and the Art of Writing. Writers write about writing.
Right.
And so I contacted a lot of like fiction writers and nonfiction writers, and
I'm sorry, I don't remember getting that phone call.
I sent it to the wrong Amanda Stern.
Oh, yeah, yeah, the Hollywood producer.
Yeah. But, you know, fiction writers, editors, mm-hmm. publishers. And one of the first people to get back to me was Jim Phillips, the famous author Jim Phillips, who gave me the following...
I don't know him.
Okay, well, I'll give a little bio.
All right, good.
And he contributed the following wonderful essay, How to Write. And so I figured that because it's a writer's conference, it might be good thing to read.
Excellent.
So, Jim Phillips, and you can take notes. There are a lot of good tips in here. Jim Phillips, of course, is the author of several works of fiction, including the novels Can't Get There From Here, You Gotta Know When to Fold Them, and the award-winning colloquial phrase I will use as a title.
Okay.
Last year he published the acclaimed work of cultural history, Ding Dang Dong, The True Story of Frere Jacques, Methamphetamine, and Chronic Insomnia. This is essay How to Write, and I'm glad that it's going to be in my anthology. And I'm glad you guys get to hear it. The art of writing can be reduced to a few simple rules. I share them with you now. Rule number one, show and tell. Most people say show, don't tell, but I stand by show and tell. Because when writers put their work out into the world, they're like little kids bringing their broken unicorns and chewed up teddy bears to class in the sad hope that someone else will love them as much as they do. And what do you have for us today, Marcy? A penetrating psychological study of a young med student who receives disturbing news from a former lover. How marvelous, have a juice box. And Timmy, little Timmy, what are you holding there? It's the Calvino-esque romp through an unnamed metropolis, much like New York, narrated by an armadillo. Such an imagination, have a juice box. Show and tell, followed by a good nap. I'll take this off. Rule number two, don't go searching for a subject, let your subject find you. You can't rush inspiration. How do you think Truman Capote came to In Cold Blood? It was just an ordinary day, and he picked up the paper to read his horoscope, and it was right there, fate. Whether it's a harrowing account of a multiple homicide, a botched Everest expedition, or a family of colorful singers trying to escape from Austria when the Nazis invade, you can't force it. Once your subject finds you, it's like falling in love. It'll be your constant companion, shadowing you, peeping in your windows, calling you at all hours of the night to leave messages like, only you understand me. Your ideal subject should be like a stalker with limitless resources, living off the inheritance he received after the suspiciously sudden death of his father. He's in your apartment pawing your stuff when you're not around, using your toothbrush, and cutting out all the really good synonyms from the thesaurus. Don't be afraid. You have a bestseller on your hands. Rule number three.
Take off the top.
Write what you know. Saul Bellow once said, fiction is the higher biography. In other words, fiction is payback on those who have wronged you. When people read my two books, My Gym Teacher Was an Abusive Bully and She Called Them Brussels Sprouts, A Survivor's Tale, they're often surprised when I tell them that there's an autobiographical element to them. Therein lies the art, I say. How do you make that, which is your everyday, into the stuff of literature? Listen to your heart. Listen to this. Ask your heart, is it true? And if it is, let it be. Once the lawyers sign off on it, you're good to go. Rule number four, don't use three words when one will do. Be concise. Don't fall in love with the gentle trilling of your mellifluous sentences. Learn how to kill your darlings, as they say. I'm reminded of the famous editor-author interaction between Gordon Lish and Raymond Carver when they're working on Carver's celebrated short story, Those Life Preservers Are Just for Show, often considered the high watermark of so-called dirty realism. You'll recall the climax when the two drunken fishermen try to calm each other after their dinghy springs a leak. In the original last lines of the story, Nat, the salty old part-time insurance agent, reassures his young charge as they cling to the beer cooler. He says, we'll get help when we hit land. I'm sure of it. No more big waves, no more sharks. We'll be safe once again, will be home. If you visit the Lilly Library at the University of Indiana and check out Gordon Lish's papers, you'll see how, with but a few deft strokes, he pared that down to create the now legendary ending, "Help, Landshark." It wasn't what Carver intended, but few could argue it was not shorter. Learn how to kill your darlings, and don't be shy about softening them up in the hostage pit for a few days before you do. Rule number 5, keep a dream diary. Rule number 6, what's not said is as important as what is said. In many classic short stories, the real action occurs in the silences. Try to keep all the good stuff off the page. Some real-world practice might help. The next time your partner comes home, ignore his or her existence for 30 minutes, and then blurt out, "This is it," and drive the car onto the neighbor's lawn. When your child approaches at bedtime, squeeze their shoulder meaningfully, and, if you're a woman, smear your lipstick across your face with the back of your hand. Or if you're a man, weep violently until they say, "It's okay, Dad." Drink out of a chipped mug, a souvenir from a family vacation, or a weekend getaway in better times, one that can trigger a 2-paragraph compare-contrast description later on. It's a bit like method acting, but you'll get the hang of it. Simply let this thought guide your every word and gesture. Something is wrong. Can you guess what it is? If you're going for something a little more pomo, repeat the above, but with fish. Rule number 7, writer's block is a tool. Use it wisely. When asked why you haven't produced anything lately, just say, "I'm blocked." Since most people think that writing is some mystical process where characters talk to you and you can hear their voices in your head, being blocked is the perfect cover when you just don't feel like working. The gods of creativity bless you, they forsake you, it's out of your hands and whatnot. Writer's block is like, "We couldn't get a babysitter," or "I ate some bad shrimp." An excuse that always gets a pass. The electric company nagging you for money, your cell provider harassing you. Just say, "I'm blocked," and you're off the hook, no questions asked. But don't overdo it. In the same way the babysitter bit loses credibility when your kids are off in grad school, there's an expiration date. After 20 years, you might want to mix it up. Throw in a Ralph Ellisonian, "Oops, my house caught fire and burnt up my opus." The specifics don't matter. The important thing is to figure out what works for you. Rule number 8 is secret. Rule number 9, have adventures. The Hemingway mode was in ascendancy for decades before it was eclipsed by trendy, fabulous exercises. The pendulum is swinging back, though, and it's going to knock these effete eggheads right out of their Aeron chairs. Keep ahead of the curve. Get out and see the world. It's not going to kill you to butch it up a little bit for a change. Book passage on a tramp steamer. Rustle up some dysentery. It's worth it for the fever dreams alone. Lose a kidney in a knife fight. You'll be glad you did. Rule number 10, revise, revise, revise. I cannot stress this enough. Revision is what you should have done the first time but didn't. It's like washing the dishes 2 days later instead of right after you finish eating. Get that draft counter going. Remove a comma and then print out another copy. That's another draft right there. Do that enough times and you can really get those numbers up, which will come in handy if someone challenges you to a draft off. When the referee blows the whistle and your opponent goes 26 drafts, you bust out with 217 and send him to the mat. And finally, rule number 11. There are no rules. If everyone jumped off a bridge, would you do it too? No. There are no rules except the ones you learn during your show and tell days. Have fun. If they don't want to be friends with you, they're not worth being friends with. And most of all, just be yourself.
That was excellent. Thank you.
Thank you, Amanda.
Welcome, Carson. So you're in the mood to answer some questions, aren't you?
Oh, heck yeah.
All right. So it is question and answer time. Yes.
Hi.
Why did you agree to come here and speak to us?
Wait, we have to repeat the question.
Why did I agree to come here and speak to you? Amanda was on the email, and I'll do anything Amanda says. And it seemed like a very nice thing to do.
I like that answer.
Any other questions? Hello? I don't know. I guess you should know, you should figure out who else they're representing. Do they actually represent the kind of fiction that you write? Ask them, here's my book. Who at, you know, which person at which house would be the right person for it? They should know, like, who's buying your type of thing, if they're about to get fired, if they bought, like, a few books for too much money, and now they're buying books for nothing, or, you know, now they're persona non grata. So you want somebody who knows who to send your book to, because different imprints have different personalities, and different editors have different things they like. So I don't know, what would you say?
Well, it's funny, because I'm actually interviewing agents right now, because I'm in between agents, and I am asking them pretty much all the questions that you asked, but what I am going to do is meet with a friend of mine who is an agent and have her write down all the questions I'm supposed to ask, because I don't really know. My first agent, I didn't ask any questions at all. He was cute, and that's why I ended up going out with him, and that's why he's not my agent anymore. But I think one thing is important to ask. If you I want to know from an agent whether they're interested in your career as a whole, or if they're more interested in just, you know, each project. I would ask them questions about that.
Yeah, I mean, like, ask, like, if this book doesn't sell, like, then what? And you want them to say, like, I have a vision for you, an arc of your career.
Exactly.
I'm into the Coulson-ness, not necessarily this book, but the whole Coulson thing over the course of years, and I want to do that for you. So you want someone who actually likes you and believes in you, really believes in you, and is not going to, like, stop returning your phone calls if this book doesn't take off for various reasons. It's a bad time in the market because certain trends, you know, are going on in the publishing world. You want them to say, hey, that didn't work out. Why don't we start talking about your next book? And here's some ideas I have for that.
Exactly. Anyone else? There's got to be questions. Okay.
Hi.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you didn't get an MFA, but if I'm not mistaken, you were teaching, right? Is that right? At Hunter at one point?
Yes. Well, I figured they hired me to, like, you know, talk about people's stories and give them advice. So that's what I did, and that's what I do. So I did not do an MFA. The question was, like, MFA in general.
To do or not to do.
Well, actually, I was more interested in how you taught.
Well, I had not taught before the first time I was asked, and I was surprised that I actually had things to say, and they seemed to be helpful to people. So I'm pretty open to different kinds of stories. I feel like MFA's got a bad rap about, like, the workshop story, which I don't really feel I've really seen that much. So, but because I read a lot of science fiction and fantasy stuff when I was a kid, and that led me to people like Garcia Marquez and Beckett, because for me, the kind of fabulism that's in fantasy is the same sort of fabulism that's in magic realism or plays or novels of the absurd, just using these sort of fantastic elements to get at the real. And so I've always never been a real snob about what you're writing, so if you came in and brought some science fiction, that'd be fine. I just want it to be science fiction that works. And if you brought in, if you did bring in some sort of Carver-esque thing or a George Saunders thing or a weird Borgesian mind-bending thing, I would try to you know, take the story on its own merits and see what you're trying to achieve. And it doesn't matter if I like to read that kind of thing. I want to try to figure out how I can help you try to do the thing you're doing. And so I just try to have an open mind. And pretty much, I think all of us would read anything which is actually well done. We just never see certain kinds of writing because we're not interested in it. But if the thing was done well and put in front of us on an airplane, we can probably enjoy it. So I just try to be very open and be very supportive. I'm not like a mean teacher. And what I really like is when someone turns in a crappy story the first week, and then a month later, another crappy story, and like, I hate this guy, I'm never going to teach again. And then a month later, there's some improvement, or they've done something really interesting and weird. And I'm like, maybe I'll teach again. So that's that.
I'm wondering, are you also asking how he is teaching college without an MFA? Is that part of your question as well, or no?
No.
Okay. Yes.
The different challenges in a book that's more personal and research-based. For me, they're all really hard, and so you have to figure out what the difficulty with this book is and how to overcome it, beat it. And so The Intuitionist and John Hammer Days have a lot of research, and so the problem is how to integrate research in an interesting way, like, Joan, did you happen to know that John Henry? There's actually a real live John Henry figure that we can talk. You know, how do you get in all the stuff you've learned and have it presented in a way that's natural, germane, organic to the text? So you learn how to do it. You do it badly, and then you start to figure out how to do it better over time. As I was saying with this, you know, more personal book where nothing really happens, like he gets his braces off in chapter 5. And that's like a big thing. How do you get people to keep going? So I was obsessed with that. There's no sort of linear plot. There's no, like, elevator mystery. There's no sort of real narrative armature. So how do I get people going from chapter to chapter? And so I had to figure out a voice that was compelling enough to keep people going, even though there's not a plot. How do I present these very sort of mundane, everyday things that we've all experienced in such a way that I'm presenting them in a new way that will be compelling to you, and it transcends its sort of very mundane everydayness. Because we're all 15 at one point, we've all had sort of summers where we were trying to figure things out. So how can I do it in such a way that it's interesting to you, and you're not just going, well, I was 15 too, who cares? So that's the problem with this one, and my next book will have a different sort of problem I have to figure out. And the point, I think that's probably also the point, is that you're not doing the same thing over and over again. If I knew how to do it, I wouldn't be doing it. Because the point is to keep challenging yourself. And there's no fun in doing another elevator inspector mystery. You did it once, why do it again? So what I like about starting something new is that I don't know if it's going to work, if it's stupid, if I can pull it off. And then you know, two-thirds of the way through, like, maybe I'm pulling it off. You know, you have to figure out how to make it work, no matter what kind of book it is or what the challenge is.
I actually have a question. So plotting it out in advance doesn't ruin it for you? It doesn't make you feel like, well, all right, I already know what it's about, so why go write it?
Yeah, I mean, it's not you know, every single thing. You know, and definitely, there are times when I'm like, introduce Lucian, the crazy PR guy, and I have no idea what he talks like, and so that mystery is still there.
Okay.
And I put off introducing Lucian for a year and then go back to it. So, I mean, I know what Lucian has to serve in terms of the plot. He has to give this to the main character. But I don't know what he talks like or walks like, and I might not know for like a long time.
Right.
And then some characters who I think are sort of walk-ons, I like their voice, and they become bigger, and that changes things. And so, you know, it does change over time, and the part of the mystery, part of the joy is like the mystery of the book and where it's going to go. But I do like to know that at the end, they are going to defuse the atomic bomb and save the world. Because
right.
Then that's on the first page. For me, that's on the first page, too.
Right.
You know?
So the characters remain a mystery to you, but the plot does not. That makes sense. Yes.
I know you have a name in the literary world, but all your books sound different from one another. Do you have to actively promote each book? And if so, what do you
mean? I have a few books. I have a name in the literary world, but they're all very different. So how is, what are the challenges of promoting each one, and do I have to promote them? Yeah, I mean, I want to, the books are very different, and I think it goes back to what I was saying before about just trying to do something different with each book, and so I'm not bored and I'm not doing the same thing. So my publisher is doing the nice favor of publishing my books, so I want to talk about them and do interviews, even though I'd rather be home, curled up, depressed, with a bottle of rum or something. This has happened a few times and my books come out. But you have to do readings, and I wasn't a good reader when I started, so I learned how to do readings because they expect you to do that. And I learned how to do an interview and how to dodge questions, how to answer questions. And so that's part of the, I feel, I guess you can be a pretentious hermit. I'm not really sort of established enough to promote my books, and it is grueling because you're just doing the same thing over and over again. But at the end of the day, you do a reading. You've done a bunch of interviews that are really boring because they ask the same questions. They haven't read the book. They're just going off of the flap copy. But then at the end, you're doing a reading in a bookstore, and people have come out to see you, and it's really great. And then at this point, I can see people who I recognized from 8 years ago, 9 years ago, and it's like, you're still with me. Get a life, you crazy bastards. And so there are bad things about promotion, but also good things, which is like you see people and you're sort of reminded of like you're not just like alone. There are actually people who like your work, hopefully. And even though you are doing different things, they're hopefully interested in what you're doing next.
That's a really good question, actually, because the literary landscape has completely changed, and it seems that almost every author has to somehow create some sort of song and dance to, promote their book. They have to essentially package and brand themselves in some ways today to get attention. So, an interesting thing to think about. Is someone in the back raising their hand? Yes.
And then we'll get you soon.
In the back, all the way in the back, and then.
Hi. I've been with the same publishing house, Anchor and Doubleday, and my first editor edited The Intuitionist and John Henry Days, and then moved to a different publishing house. And so since then, I've had for the last three books, I've had the same editor, and it's been really neat. I mean, being at the same place, working with the same people, in publicity or whatever, because they've remained stable even though my editors haven't. But I think it's it's been very fortunate to be at the same place, and they got me at the beginning with my weird book, and then other things. Good things happened, they were there to keep encouraging me. So I'm not the same editor, but I've been the same place, and now that my book is coming out in April, and the process is coming up again, the publishing process, I feel comfortable and it was a crazy 10 years, and definitely when I was writing, I was upset about being dumped by my agent. I never thought it would, turn out like this, but actually, it's been, sort of sweet, I guess.
And you're still with Nicole.
And I'm still with the same agent, yes. She hasn't dumped me.
She's not gone.
You have a question, sir?
Yeah, that was actually my question, was the question about your stuff, your books changing, made me think of that you were working with the same agent, and yet you also said that agents have to sort of be up on just the sort of thing that you do. So that seems kind of...
Well, no, because I've been in the same place. She hasn't had to figure out where I'd be a good, where would be the next good fit for me, if there is such a thing. But yes, when you are looking for an agent, you want to know that they know who at this house is the right person. Hi. An adult novel. I mean, the flap copy was a little YAE, and so I wanted to change it for the final version. It just sounded like maybe, I think I'm old enough to have some distance from childhood, but it sounded like maybe really icky and young and unformed. So it's adult fiction. I have a friend who's like an editor, and he's like, you should definitely send it, get it out there to like the librarian, the YA librarian circuit. So maybe they'll do that as a side thing, but it's not going to be primarily marketed.
Anyone else?
All right, well, groovy. I hope you guys had a really good couple days. It was really helpful, and I'm glad you guys were here. Thanks
a lot.
Me too.
Thanks so much for coming. Thank you for joining us. It was a pleasure to meet you.